Welcome to British History, Royals, Rebels, and Romantics. You know, T.S. Eliot once said that April is the cruelest month, but I hope we prove him wrong this April. I'm ready for some fun and flowers and all of the things included in spring. And speaking of fun, it's time for some epic fun stories by an epic storyteller. April is, after all, the anniversary of the birth and death of one of the greatest storytellers of all time. In fact, the greatest, in my opinion, William Shakespeare. This month, we're going to shake up spring and have fun with Shakespeare. We'll be looking at some of the most fascinating and funniest facts about the plays. We'll be considering how the Tower of London and other famous London sites shape the action. And we'll be chatting with Michael Blanding, author of North by Shakespeare, quote, a rogue scholar's quest for the truth behind the bard's work. So sit back and enjoy as we explore Shakespeare's take on the royals, rebels, and romantics of British history. It's spring, time for fun, time to be outside, time to play sports, time to enjoy flowers and birds, time for picnics, time for Shakespeare. Wait, what? Shakespeare? Fun? Isn't Shakespeare serious and impossible to understand and boring and old and irrelevant and pretty much the opposite of fun? In a word, no. Shakespeare can be made to be boring and old and serious and irrelevant, but it doesn't need to be that way. In fact, Shakespeare started out as a guy who moved to London to pursue the career he wanted, which was to dress up in costume and act and write stories that appealed to all kinds of people and make money by creating popular entertainment. His plays were full of naughty jokes and silly characters and recognizable family drama and challenges to authority. The people watching the plays were eating and drinking while they watched, and they even threw a bit of food at the actors if things got somewhat dull. Shakespeare shook up things in the reigns of Elizabeth I and James I. Joined by fellow playwrights and actors, Shakespeare made English theater a vibrant part of London life. Despite the plague closing theaters for months at a time, and cynical censors who didn't want anyone questioning authority, Shakespeare created worlds out of words that are fun and tragic and controversial and full of family and friends and enemies and armies. So let's shake up spring with Shakespeare. Birdman. William Shakespeare grew up in the countryside. And yes, I'm just putting it out there that I absolutely believe the guy from Stratford wrote the plays. By collaborating with other playwrights and actors, and by using sources that were available at the time, and by using his extraordinary imagination and talent. We can have a discussion about authorship another time. Today, we're just moving on. So, this guy grew up in the countryside and knew all about animals and plants. His plays are full of gardens. In fact, birds end up being a big part of Shakespeare's plays and history. Shakespeare uses images from nature to evoke emotions and create the environment for his characters to act out their stories. According to dramaturg and theater critic Drew Lichtenberg, Shakespeare, quote, uses birds to express the depth of romantic feeling in Romeo and Juliet. He uses them to express the screech of night owls in the Scottish play. And that's Macbeth, for those of you who don't participate in those superstitions about saying Macbeth. And King Lear. He uses them for every dramatic purpose, end quote. Shakespeare mentions more than 60 different bird species, and there are more than 600 references to those winged creatures. Here are a few examples. In Midsummer Night's Dream, when Nick Bottom is transformed by Puck into a creature with the head of an ass, he states he will sing to show his friends he is not afraid. So he begins singing about birds. The ousel crow, so black of hue, with orange tawny bill, the throstle with his note so true, the wren with little quill, the finch, the sparrow, and the lark, the plainsong cuckoo gray, whose note full many a man doth mark, and dares not answer nay. Then, in Love's Labour's Lost, men pledge they will stay away from women and romance. Don Adriano de Armado sings of spring and the mocking of married men. The cuckoo then on every tree mocks married men, for thus sings he, cuckoo, 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 O word of ear, unpleasing to the married ear. We also have one of the very first, if not the very first, uses of a now common expression, wild goose chase, when Mercutio scolds his friend Romeo, nay, if thy wits run the wild goose chase, I have done. For thou hast more of the wild goose in one of thy wits than, I am sure, I have in my whole five. Was I with you there for the goose? And, of course, here is Beatrice assuring everyone, including Benedick, that she is absolutely, positively never going to fall in love and get married. I thank God and my cold blood I am of your humor for that. I had rather hear my dog bark at a crow than a man swear he loves me. One of the strangest Shakespeare-related bird stories involves a German immigrant to the United States, Eugene Schlieffen. In 1890, reportedly determined to introduce as many of the birds mentioned in Shakespeare's plays as possible into North America, he brought starlings to Central Park. Now, some question whether Shakespeare was really his motivation, and think instead it was because of the practical and aesthetic value of these birds. But many believe the Shakespeare enthusiast was Shakespeare-focused. In any case, the 60 starlings he released on a winter day in 1890 have turned into more than 200 million European starlings in the United States. The birds are considered a nuisance, or worse. Michael Beeger, National Coordinator of the U.S. Department of Agriculture Airports Wildlife Hazards Program, said he and his colleagues often refer to them as feathered bullets because of the dangers they pose to air travel. In 1960, starlings flew into the engine of a plane and caused it to crash, killing 62 people and representing the most deadly bird strike in aviation history. Yeah, birdman indeed. Play ball. Another spring tradition here in the United States is baseball. A friend who knows all about my dual obsession with Shakespeare and baseball gave me a fun book, David Goodenough's Shakespeare on Baseball. Here are a few of his Bard and baseball gems. If you don't get the baseball references, just enjoy the fun. About the All-Star Game, and perhaps this year in particular. Why, this is very Midsummer Madness from Twelfth Night. About Babe Ruth. He doth bestride the narrow earth like a colossus, from Julius Caesar. About a game where you come from behind to win in extra innings. So foul and fair a day I have not seen, from Macbeth. About a long-lasting hitting slump, or about a no-hitter, such as the one the San Diego Padres just experienced for the first time a few days ago. What? Not one hit? From The Merchant of Venice. Something an outfielder might cry going after a fly ball. I'll catch it ere it come to ground, from Macbeth. And inspired by the book, I've come up with a few of my own. About Ricky Henderson. By heaven, I'll steal away, from All's Well That Ends Well. About any batter facing Mariano Rivera. Something wicked this way comes, from Macbeth. My description of that final moment in the 2001 World Series final game. If you have tears, prepare to shed them now, from Julius Caesar. About Derek Jeter's final bat at Yankee Stadium, you have hit it, from Henry IV, Part 1. And finally, about a World Series win, oh, wonderful, wonderful, most wonderful, wonderful, and yet again wonderful, and after that, out of all whooping, from As You Like It. Much ado about springtime fun. What I really want to talk about is a play that reminds me of all the excitement and anticipation and warmth and wonder of spring. The play that really represents spring to me is one of my all-time favorites, Much Ado About Nothing. Although not set in any particular season, the play feels like spring to me. Full of possibility, warm and sunny, sudden and unexpected showers and trouble on the horizon, some hard work, some questions about how serious the storm will be, and ultimately a lovely day. One of the things I especially appreciate about Much Ado is the character of Beatrice. Shakespeare gives this female character a full range of language to express all of her ideas and emotions, to explore her changing feelings about Claudio, Benedick, and herself and what she wants, and to put her desires into words, then change the desires and ask for something else. One of my favorite considerations about Much Ado is the PBS Shakespeare Uncovered series, where Helen Hunt takes a look at various elements of Shakespeare's background and family, different productions of the play over the years, and the rich legacy of the characters Shakespeare has given us. Helen Hunt might not be the first person you imagine to play Shakespeare, but she's no stranger to the Bard. She played Bianca in the 1990 Shakespeare in the Park production of Taming of the Shrew, appearing alongside Tracy Ullman and Morgan Freeman. She then played Viola in the Lincoln Center production of Twelfth Night in 1998. Then in 2010, she played the marvelous character of Beatrice in the Shakespeare Center of Los Angeles production of Much Ado About Nothing. So when Helen Hunt takes us on a tour of the play, she does so from her own experience. If you haven't seen this episode, I definitely and wholeheartedly recommend it. I'll put some info in the show notes. What is it then that makes Much Ado such a spring-like play? In my opinion, it's the subtle tension between the fun and frolic we see so easily and the darker and more complicated elements that simmer just below the surface waiting to bubble up. It feels like spring, where a sunny day can descend into a thunderstorm with little warning, with winds and even hail that can undo all your efforts to have a healthy garden full of flowers. Let's look at some examples. First, I have to focus on Beatrice. Shakespeare Uncovered suggests that Beatrice might have something in common with Shakespeare's daughter, Susanna Hall, who is remembered in her epitaph in Holy Trinity Church as, quote, witty above her sex. Perhaps that wit, not typically encouraged in women who were supposed to be silent during Shakespeare's lifetime, inspired her father. Susanna Shakespeare married John Hall, who was a physician, in 1607. They had one child, Elizabeth, the next year. The family moved to Hall's Croft in Stratford around 1613. We know Susanna was literate to some degree. Some scholars believe she helped compose the memorial epitaph to her mother. Shakespeare appointed Susanna and her husband as executors of his will and left the bulk of his estate to them. The Halls moved into New Place after Shakespeare's death. Some believe Susanna would have inherited Shakespeare's papers and therefore was likely involved in the printing of the first folio of Shakespeare's work in 1623. Susanna's status was reinforced when Queen Henrietta Maria, wife of Charles I, visited Stratford and was a guest at New Place. The Queen was a well-known theater fan, and it's easy to imagine she wanted to meet Shakespeare's daughter and learn more about the playwright. Of course, we don't know any firm connection between Susanna and the character of Beatrice, and much of what we do know about Susanna comes after the retirement and death of her father. But we can see a confidence in Shakespeare's daughter, and we are told of her wit. It's the first attribute listed on her tombstone. So it's not impossible or out of the question to imagine that Shakespeare may have had her somewhat in mind when he created Beatrice and her sparkling dialogue. But it's technically Hero and Claudio who are the actual main characters of the play, according to Shakespeare's sources. The British Library shares a few of the sources for Shakespeare's play, including Canto 5 of the Orlando Furioso, translated by Sir John Harrington, and La Prima di Nuela by Matteo Bandello, both of which focus on the hero-Claudio relationship and the role of Don John in disrupting that marriage. The Beatrice Benedict storyline is not part of these originals. Most scholars believe that part of the story is Shakespeare's own invention, perhaps inspired by Thomas Toby's translation of Castiglione's The Courtier. John Lilly's plays also feature characters who first profess disdain for each other, but ultimately fall in love. But the primary storyline is that of Hero and Claudio, and the other elements and subplots are there to support that storyline. Well, it may have started out that way, but Beatrice and Benedict steal the show. They have been the focus from early on. In 1640, poet Leonard Diggs wrote, quote, "Let but Beatrice and Benedict be seen. Lo, in a trice, the cockpit, galleries, boxes, all are full." Shakespeare's superfan, David Garrick, first played Benedict in 1748, and he continued to play that part for nearly 30 years. Famed performers Henry Irving and Ellen Terry played that couple in the late 19th century. 20th and 21st century Benedict Beatrice pairings include Sir John Gielgud alongside Diana Wayward, Dame Peggy Ashcroft and Margaret Leighton, Dame Judi Dench and Donald Sinden, Harriet Walter and Nicholas LeProvost, Kenneth Branagh and Emma Thompson, Mark Rylance and Janet McTeer, as well as Helen Hunt and Tom Erwin in the production I mentioned earlier. Those are the parts people want to play, not Hero and Claudio. Why? Well, a quick comparison of the characters of Beatrice and Hero gives us one answer. While Beatrice has all the language she needs, Hero has comparatively little. According to opensourceshakespeare.org, Hero has 44 speeches, most of which are short, while Beatrice has more than 100, some of which are long and complex. Hero's most animated language and attitude usually comes in performance when she is tricking Beatrice into thinking Benedict is in love with her. While speaking for herself, Hero has less to say. A similar thing comes when we compare Claudio and Benedict. Benedict is full of swagger, but at the same time, playful and somehow charming. His lines are funny and endearing, and even surprisingly romantic. He is able to see through the accusations against Hero and quickly believes in her innocence. On the other hand, Claudio seems all too eager to believe the worst in people who have given him no reason to do so. He wants the prince to woo Hero in his behalf. Come on, speak for yourself, man. Then he believes the prince would move on Hero himself. After discovering that the prince has not actually betrayed him, Claudio quickly believes that Hero has. By the end of the play, many audience members don't believe Claudio deserves another chance at happiness. Shakespeare sets up both couples by using a framework where people trick each other into believing something that's not readily known. In fact, nothing was probably pronounced noting or overhearing at the time of the play. In the case of Don John tricking Claudio into believing that first the prince and then Hero has betrayed him, the trick is based on presenting an outright falsehood as the truth. Claudio is easily fooled. Benedict and Beatrice are also easily fooled. The difference is the nature of the trick and the people perpetuating it. Although he doesn't cause a war or leave us a stage full of bodies, Don John is one of the most perniciously evil characters in Shakespeare because he causes problems and attempts to ruin lives of other people just to do it. He declares himself a plain-dealing villain and then spoils things because he can. Folger Shakespeare Library Director Emeritus Dr. Gail Kern Pastor believes he's a kind of sociopath. He feels no remorse. Following Don John's lead, Claudio exacts a horrible revenge on Hero in a verbal attack that has such violence embedded in it that Hero collapses and several people believe she is dead. Such sexual slander is a devastating weapon to use against a young woman, and Claudio is vicious in his statements. Even though he is acting on a lie, the ease with which he accepts Don John's statements over Hero's previous behavior and heartfelt self-defense, and the utter rage with which he publicly shames her, makes it hard to imagine a happy ending. Compared to that trick, is the trick staged against Beatrice and Benedict. Their friends and family decide to fool them into thinking the other is deeply in love. As we can all see, the banter between the two is witty and biting, but it's based on something else. Tipping them into believing they are loved is easy because they want to believe it. Tipping them into admitting they are in love is easy because they want to believe that too. And it's a delight to watch. I've seen productions where the people playing Beatrice and Benedict actually go out into the audience to hide while overhearing what other people are saying. It's a delightful way to be pulled right into the story. But the fun of Beatrice and Benedict, like spring flowers and sports, is threatened at the wedding of Hero and Claudio when the groom turns so violently against his bride. After realizing he is horribly in love with Beatrice and declaring to her, quote, "I do love nothing in the world so well as you," Benedict demonstrates his love by choosing to believe her. When Beatrice asks him to kill Claudio for wronging her cousin, Benedict initially resists, but he stays and he listens and he finally asks, quote, "Think you in your soul the Count Claudio hath wronged Hero?" When Beatrice assures him that she does, he says, "Enough, I am engaged, I will challenge him." Benedict chooses to believe Beatrice instead of his war buddies. He chooses to believe in Hero instead of the accusations and condemnation. I think that's when we know it's spring and the storm will be over. Up until this point, the Hero Claudio story is on track for a tragedy. In fact, as I heard Dr. Michael Whitmore, director of Folger Shakespeare Library, discuss, Much Ado and Othello are really the same story. An evil man convinces his friend that the woman he loves has been untrue. Immoral women represent such horror that death seems the only way out. But the lurching toward tragedy is held back, I think, once Benedict shows his willingness to love Beatrice and believe her. Enter the ridiculous Watch, so inept but somehow able to uncover the truth of Don John's betrayal. Then follows the drama of Claudio's repentance once he realizes he was completely wrong and thinks he killed an innocent woman. Repentance which, by the way, seems pretty weak to me compared to the seriousness of what he's done. And then the added drama of the veiled bride who turns out to be Hero herself instead of a cousin. All ends with a wedding, but we're not quite satisfied, are we? The moment we've been waiting for comes after that, when Benedict looks around at the masked women and asks, "Which is Beatrice?" Their stumbling, awkward, unwilling expressions of love in front of their friends and family take some time and effort, but it happens. The two will marry, as Benedict asks, "Let's have a dance ere we are married, that we may lighten our own hearts and our wives' heels." So the play ends with a kiss and a dance, and the warmth and beauty of spring returns. Shake it up this spring. It's April 2021 as I'm recording this. Last spring in 2020, we were entering a frightening time with an unknown illness that was changing everything. We've spent months without being able to gather with family and friends, months without travel, months of staying 6 feet away from nearly everyone. Theaters and museums are largely still closed. Trips and events have been canceled. And so many of us have lost loved ones, breaking our hearts. Now, I feel there is hope. There are birds singing and new flowers and warmer temperatures. And Shakespeare, someone who could capture the deepest tragedies and sorrows and despairs, offers us funny bird quotations that may have inspired a crazy bird outcome. He offers us quotations that somehow apply to baseball games and players who would come hundreds of years after he wrote the stuff. And he shows us how to open ourselves up to the hope that's represented by spring and the chance to love people again. As Antony says in Antony and Cleopatra, "The April's in her eyes, it is love's spring, and these the showers to bring it on. Be cheerful." Let's all take his advice. Be safe, be well, and be cheerful. And join us next time when we'll be looking at how locations like the Tower of London shaped the world of Shakespeare's plays. Thank you so much for listening. I really appreciate your joining me to explore the royals, rebels, and romantics of British history. Before you go, please take just a moment to subscribe and share with a friend. And I'd really appreciate it if you leave a rating. It makes it easier for people to find us. So is April bringing you a flowering of ideas with different ways of looking at and experiencing Shakespeare? I hope so. I would love to hear from you. Please reach out on social media. You'll find me on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at Shakeup History or Carol Ann Lloyd Shakeup History. And let's keep shaking up history together.